Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And as our daily reminder, that debt is fraud. And I just wanted to remind you that there are efforts. I've been asked, and people are coordinating on having prayers for the Republic and those who are working and supporting the holding of our government accountable, or more specifically, holding our public servants accountable. Because we can't hold buildings accountable, and we can't hold, artifacts and things and land. We have to hold our public servants accountable, whether they inherited the mess or whether they're a part of the mess or whether they're the cause of the mess. We got to hold them accountable. So anyway, we got Tammy with us, and we're going through Article 2, and we just finished Section 3. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to kind of do a repeat on Section 3 before we dive into Section 4, if that's okay with you.
That's fine with me.
All right, great. So what I wanted to do was really cover the last clause. He, speaking of the president, shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed and shall commission all of the officers of the United States. So what that means is the president, his responsibility is to make sure that the Constitution is being complied to, that all laws in pursuance to the Constitution are carried out. It doesn't give him the authority to, you know, agree to unconstitutional laws. And so this is where I think there needs to be, unfortunately, I mean, you'd never think that you'd have to say in a contract that you actually have to, you know, you have to live up to your obligations, right? I mean,
yeah,
you're taking an oath. They have you take an oath. But then following that to say, okay, you've taken the oath. Now you got to live up to that.
Yeah, now you have to make another oath to say that you're going to live up to the first oath.
And so I know that people, you know, people are very apprehensive and very standoffish in signing the pledge, that pledge that you signed. And so there's lots of people that look at that and go, I'm not going to sign this. That means you can hold me accountable. I'm telling you, folks, if people don't sign the pledge, then they are not worthy of your vote. It's that simple. So when we look at this, I think this needs to be amended as well as the veto. I believe the president should be responsible for vetoing any law that is not constitutional. That flies in the face of reason as well. I mean, you'd think that they can't create a law that violates the Constitution, but they've been doing it. And they started doing it in the very onset. And as a matter of fact, I would think that it should be a capital offense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's tantamount to treason. And you know what? Had there been a capital offense tied to, you know, passing or submitting and passing a law that was considered a direct violation of the Constitution, then Hamilton would have hanged.
Yeah.
And, you know, and these other people that thought that they could go down this path of, you know, shenanigans and perverting and subverting our government and Constitution. But anyway, so I just wanted to cover that one point because we kind of lingered in this one section, we lingered on this concept of who has the authority to drive the State of the Union. So anyway, let's go into Section 4 now.
All right. The President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors.
Right. And so this is where there is clarity of a removal of anybody in the Constitution. if we go back to Article 1 basically tells the Senate that they'll keep track and monitor and manage the ethics and punishments of members of the Senate. And that's the same thing with the members of the House. And so, in other words, you got the fox who's taken over the hen house, and there are no hens left.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, all right. So let's take a look at Article 3. And Section 1, this is all about the judiciary, right? So when we look at the importance, the role of importance in our government, our representatives is the first and foremost in our government because they're the sovereigns. This is a Republican form of government, so everything is central on them. Only they can create the laws. Only they can, you know, declare war and those types of things. So Article 2, I don't want to skip that, but we just covered that. That's all about the executive branch. Article 3 is about the judiciary. And their hands are extremely tied, but let's go into Section 1.
The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The judges, both of the Supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior, and shall at stated times receive for their services a compensation which shall not be diminished during their continuance in office.
Now, that's kind of interesting that they can't be diminished, because to me, if the government behaved badly and they inflated their salaries and they inflated our currency, I honestly think that that's one way that there should be a level of pain that we can inflict upon those who are serving.
Yeah, no kidding.
But anyway, I mean, it kind of turns the table of at-will employee, right? But anyway, and the other problem is the fact that they serve for a lifetime, but that's down the road a little bit. So go ahead and read Section 2.
The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority.
Okay, right there. So that right there is their jurisdiction. You see, the punctuation after authority is a semicolon. So in other words, that is one clause. This is the jurisdiction of the judiciary. Now, they have some ancillary jurisdictions on top of this, but when it comes to dealing with the states and dealing with the parties in the compact or the citizens in the states, it only extends to law and equity arising under this Constitution. Right? That's what it says.
Yeah.
And then the laws of the United States and the treaties made, and it's highlighted, or which shall be made under their authority. In other words, they can't, they cannot ratify a treaty regarding something that is not enumerated. In other words, the treaty of the UN, that there's no enumeration for the federal government to adjoin the states of the United States and the people to a foreign joint new nation like the UN.
Right.
So when we look at that right there, that under their authority is key. I can't emphasize that enough. That is the key right there. Now, they go into, and you can see the highlighted, or I should say the italicized part. And then there's modified by Amendment 11. So a part of this shouldn't be read, actually.
Okay.
Because they no longer have this jurisdiction, that jurisdiction. We would need to read 11, but see, when you're reading a normal constitution, it doesn't tell you this.
Hmm.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. To all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, to controversies between two or more states, between a state and citizen of another state, between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states, and between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens or subjects.
Okay. So it's kind of clear that these are ancillary jurisdictions. So they have jurisdiction over ambassadors and their foreign engagements. They have jurisdiction over ministers and consuls. It's basically the same thing, because an ambassador, minister, and consul, depending on the relations we have. If we have good open relations, there is an emissary or an ambassador. Emissary, same, same. A minister and a consul are secondary. In a lot of nations, we have a primary ambassador, then we may have ministers and consuls that are out in different parts because we have that much interface. As a matter of fact, a good case in point, when we think about Benghazi and the attack on Benghazi on September 11th, where we lost those four men and the ambassador because he was up at that consul, it was all suspect. And so anyway, that building up in Benghazi was a consul, and there was a basically a minister up there that was reporting to. And as a matter of fact, because the tensions were so bad, they pretty much shut that consul down. So the fact that they even sent Ambassador, Stevens, I think, up there, I'm really bad with names, but the fact that they sent him up there was basically tantamount to sending, was it Ukiah or Ukai? When King David basically wrote letters and had to give them to his general and basically was, you know, putting this guy in the front and don't defend him. In other words, let this guy get slain. And it was the same thing, sending that ambassador up there that because he was sent up there by the president.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he walked into that trap only means that he was put to death. Anyway,
right.
Anyway, so the next stanza, the next paragraph, go ahead and read that and we'll get into that red part. Go ahead and read that.
Okay. In all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, and those in which a state shall be party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In all other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such expectations and under such regulations as the Congress shall make.
Okay, so now we have this look. The Congress actually has the control over how they're supposed to function, but the reason they have original jurisdiction is because those things are directly related to the federal government. Everything else should be handled by the other courts. And the problem is the other courts have had a revolving door, which basically opened everything up for the Supreme Court. So when we look at cases going into a case, let's say a case going into a district court where the state is claiming that, you know, they have a right to access their land. The fact that they went into that court means that they've surrendered their jurisdiction because they shouldn't have to go into a court over anything that's not enumerated.
Mm.
Remember, only those things enumerated.
So then what do they do?
So what they need to do is they need to make an appeal to all the other states. What needs to happen, if you understand republic review, what needs to happen is we exercise republic review, and then when we're done, we create mechanisms for the state to quickly get engaged so that we don't have to go through this process. In other words, we create these standing committees across the union so that these committees can quickly jump in and say, hold on here, you're doing something that is not enumerated. Don't make us get up and spank you. Stop.
Right, so it seems the majority of the work is just getting the standing committees going. Correct. With enough states.
So the majority of the work is actually trying to prove to people how unconstitutional the things that they're levying upon us are.
Yeah.
Getting people to understand and then finally understand what needs to be done. So go ahead and read the next one. The trial of all crimes.
Okay. The trial of all crimes except in cases of impeachment shall be by jury, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crime shall have been committed. But when not committed within any state, the trial shall be at such place or places as the Congress may by law have directed.
Okay, so basically, they're trying to make it so that the trial is close to the vicinage of the person, if possible, especially a trial by jury. But bottom line, that's why they set up district courts. Bottom line, most of the issues we take into the court shouldn't even be there.
Right.
They said, hey, they put it out to the progressives, those people who wanted to grow government. Even though we don't have jurisdiction, bring it to us and we'll accept jurisdiction. We're ignoring our limitations. This is how they grew their jurisdiction. Excuse me. So as we look at the problem, we have to stop surrendering our jurisdiction. Okay, now, Section 3. Go ahead.
Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court.
Who were the first people convicted of treason? Do you know?
No.
Do you know when the first conviction of treason was executed?
I don't.
Do you remember reading about the Whiskey Rebellion?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So in the Whiskey Rebellion, how many people were found guilty of treason?
I don't recall.
Okay, 24 were arrested and tried and charged with treason. Two were convicted. So okay. Two men in 1794 were convicted of treason in rebelling against the taxes of the whiskey tax. And so when you read this again, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Or if you directly rebel against the Constitution, in other words, you are now positioning yourself as an opposer of constitutional government. You're running an insurrection. It's the same as treason. And we've completely lost sight. And the reason why is because they know that they're treasonous today. Go ahead and read the next one.
The Congress shall have power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attainted.
Right. So that means that they can't go after somebody else and punish them like family members or what have you via this corruption of blood. So anyway, okay. Let's dive into Article 4. Go ahead.
Full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state, and the Congress may by general laws prescribe the manner in which such acts, records, and proceedings shall be proved, and the effect thereof.
Okay, so here's the question. It says, full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state, and the Congress may, by the general laws prescribed, the manner in which such acts according and proceedings shall be proved and the effect thereof. Now, there's also in Article 2 or Article 1 that the United States shall enjoy the full faith and credit of the Union. And I'm paraphrasing. What that means is that in fulfilling their duties, they have the ability to take out debt. And in fulfilling their duties, they have the ability to spend on those things that they have the authority to spend on. When we look at what government is doing, then we see government, the federal government and even state government, actually violating the trust of the people. And they're actually working with those who are enemies of the Constitution, foreigners and so forth, foreign entities, corporations, whatever, globalists like Bill Gates. So we find that we actually have our government acquiescing or agreeing to do to fraud the people.
Yeah.
There have been, and I don't keep track, there have been assertions of bankruptcies in the past. Right, wrong, or indifferent, I don't spend my time chasing conspiracy theories. What I do is I say they don't have the authority to do any of this. There's never been an amendment. There's never been a proper delegation for them to spend that money or what have you. So all of the things that they did it fraudulently. Even when they declared bankruptcy, they did that fraudulently.
Right.
And they did things on top of that to defraud the people further. So the focus should be that they don't have the authority. This is the only position where we are on top of the mountain. When we start fighting with them and going into court and saying, you know, I don't recognize this authority. I'm a sovereign citizen. In other words, when people go into court, yeah, they are...
You just recognized it by going to court.
Absolutely. That's exactly what they did. But I will tell you that there are people that do that that have no other recourse. In other words, they're being attacked and they're being basically destroyed, because I've seen this happen to people where they get destroyed and they are forced to literally surrender their citizenship and say, I'm just going to be an inhabitant. And then everything changes. And so I don't know, you know, I know you don't pay taxes, but I know that there's a lot of things that literally change in your life. But anyway, let's go into section 2.
The citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states.
Okay, so that right there basically is the establishment of reciprocity. If you have a right, if you're driving, if your state allows 15 years of age to drive a car, then you have the right, the privileges, and you are immune from citations from another state if you take that car and you drive into that state. Now, whether you're a citizen or not at that point in time is a different story. Does that make sense?
Right.
So in some cases, it may be a ludicrous example, because at the age of 15, in those days, I think you were probably a citizen and you were capable of serving in the Civil War or in the military service. They started growing or adding to that because they just said that's just too young for a young man to, you know, to be able to take on that responsibility, that life-ending responsibility of serving their country. And I look at that and I go, how, you know, that's really placating and actually insulting those who have lived before us. And it's almost like, why we became so not liberal, we became so enabling of bad behavior to allow children to delay their maturing and delay their engagement. Now, I've been on record of saying those people who want to pursue education and those things, I think it's okay. We're going into a break here in just a few seconds. But
okay.
I think it's okay. And as a matter of fact, I think there's a way to do this where we can actually make it so that, you know, they don't have full voting privileges. Because let me take this when we come back from the break, because I just don't want to bleed this into the break and then have it fragmented. So when we come back, I'll kind of talk about how, you know, citizens should have, well, we have the level of technology to address this. We'll be right back. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so for years and years and years, when they founded this country, they didn't have technology to be able to provide a, a buffet type of voting system. In other words, let's just look down at all of the differentiations of things which people would vote in. The federal level, in voting for your elector and in voting for your representative, as well as your senator today, in the federal offices, then they only have certain abilities. And most of those abilities regarding and how they affect us is really tax. They don't have the power to create laws within states, but they do that now. And if we got the federal government into full check to where they are abiding by the current Constitution and not affecting our everyday lives, then why is it so important that everybody be able to vote in that election? Now, if you're pushing for a democracy and mob rule, then that's what you want. It's one thing to say you have, because we don't even have that with our electors, but it's one thing to say that everybody should be able to choose their elector for the president. But when it comes to having a representative in Congress, in the House of Representatives, to vote for that person, that you have to have some stake, you have to have some skin in that to be able to say, hey, you got to represent me on these issues. And when you look at what those issues are, they really, other than war, and because they do war, then they really shouldn't be able to, you know, you shouldn't be able to vote in those. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, because otherwise, I mean, you know, the legislature, they're supposed to follow the Constitution, mm-hmm. uphold it and defend it, mm-hmm. and the average person, you know, they're just going to vote for what they want, so that it's just mob rule.
Right. And so,
instead of defending the Constitution.
So technically, the voting standards are really left to the states. Okay? So they really are left to the states, because the state actually creates the standards, in a generic sense, the federal government creates the standards for the militia and who is going to have to, go into service, into harm's way and so forth. And we've moved towards a full voluntary system, but actually to go to a full voluntary system, they would have to amend the Constitution. And what I mean by that is the states are supposed to always maintain a militia ready to go, whether we're at peace or not. And the fact that they went to this voluntary force, when they implemented the draft, that first off, the draft was unconstitutional. The federal government could not actually have you get enlisted to serve in their army.
Right.
In other words, what that basically tells you is they created a standing army and there's no way around it. No. The way they formed the army is by calling up the militia, to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, and that's all. So the whole intent of the army was to guard the motherland. The Navy was a different thing. The Navy and the Marine Corps is something that they actually have, and so they could actually call up or establish some form of draft or what have you for the Navy and the Marine Corps. But for the National Guard and all of that, that goes away. We have to restore the militia, and we have to restore the militia to the counties. We don't even have a structure at the state level where every county actually has the ability to protect themselves.
Right.
So, I mean...
So then how do they get...
Go ahead.
What's the proper way for them to have a militia?
So... The proper way for them to have a militia is for the states to actually put a requisition into the federal government to say, we need this much money to equip, to train, and to basically establish these standards that you're creating for us across our state to have enough people ready to serve. Now, the problem is, and this is what happens, if we actually had if the United States, all states in this union, were fully engaged in training people, in other words, if the children in, I would say, sixth grade and up, maybe, or fifth grade and up, started learning gun safety, tactics, and those types of things, then the children would be prepared by the time they reach service age of 17. So that they know and understand. I mean, I'm not talking about them firing live rifles, but I think that there should be a succession of when are they capable of starting to understand that they're growing into becoming a adult. This goes back to this concept of the way we've created this diametrically opposed society where we've got all these people enabled to do whatever they want to do to make themselves feel good. And then there's a few people that actually kind of grow up and say, I'm going to go serve my country. Those are two diametrically opposed paradigms. And the fact that we have enabled that type of bad behavior of not becoming engaged, not becoming a contributing citizen in one way or the other is the root of one of our many problems. But when we look at the militia, the states need to take the militias back. And what I'm really trying to talk about is elections. Who should vote? If you have no property, if you're a renter and you don't have any property, then you shouldn't vote on any property tax, period. And we have the technology to say, okay, does this person actually, when you're registered to vote, they'll do all the data checks to make sure that you are a property holder. And as soon as you sell property and not possessing property in that state, doink, I mean, you're definitely removed from being able to vote on those specific things. So that then when a person actually goes to their county to vote or what have you, it doesn't even have to be electronic. They can just print your ballot. You can boop, 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 fill it out right there in your precinct and be done with however you voted. But I honestly believe that when we look at how to do this, it should be appropriate. I'm not the king, but it should be appropriate. You should have skin in the game to be able to be directly affected or to be able to directly vote in those particular races or issues. Does that make sense?
It does, except for if you're renting, I would think that it would occur to them that if the property owner's taxes go up, their rent's going to go up.
It doesn't. And as a matter of fact, what ends up happening is they vote for people to get into office to create, what do they call that, rent control?
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, in other words, the minions, the people that don't want to become a property owner, a person that's responsible for things, then... Those people, end up pushing more and more. This is how we drift more and more towards socialism. And so there needs to be opportunities and privileges. But to me, as I look at our election system and I look at how everybody else does it, like when you look at the governance of a corporation, a publicly traded corporation, who gets to vote in those four governance elections on a yearly or every other year, whenever they do it? Who gets to vote in that?
Well, somebody with a share in the property.
There you go. You have to have a share. You have to be an owner. You have to have stake. And so we need to look at our system that way to say, hold on here. Why are you even getting your fingers into this pot? You don't even belong in this room.
Yeah.
You know, you can't even come in the kitchen. You're not even feeding yourself. If you're on welfare and all of those other things, then the question is, you know, are you fully functioning as a U.S. citizen? I understand that when government is doing things that they shouldn't do, this is where they get empowered to do bad things. And I think that getting government out of the social services, getting them out of the, I'll just call it compassionate services. That's what I usually call it. The government should not be doing that. That should be left to the communities and the religions.
Yeah.
Same, all the compassionate services, whether it's welfare, whether it's education, all of that needs to get out from underneath government so that that way they're not doing that. And then that way it's not something that's being leveraged except in the ways that the institution feels. So like, I would see that the majority of the Christian churches would not step in. They would only give bare minimum support to the people that are starving, but they're lushes, they're alcoholics or what have you, and they're still addicted. They're not. It's one thing to offer them help, but it's kind of like the leading the horse to water. You can't necessarily force that person to, you know, quit drinking and to, you know, get away from their addiction. They have to want to do that. And I've always believed that, you know, we need to be there ready for when they want to cross that line to get away from addiction. But you only get so many shots at this because
ready, but not enabling.
Absolutely. So because we look at our healthcare system actually enables bad behavior. I mean, that's one of the reasons why when you find hospitals and healthcare, you know, branches and those types of things, you'll usually find a large homeless crowd close by.
Yeah.
So that when they have their OD, it's just, you know, a 5-minute ride for the ambulance to come pick them up. Most of these hospitals have stopped carrying ambulance care. Just because of that, it's just being abused.
Absolutely.
So anyway, you know, I don't want to wear a crown at all. I think that these are honest adult conversations that have to be had amongst the adults. And we need to actually stop saying everybody should have stake in everything. That's just not reasonable, and it is not rational. So anyway. All right, so we're done with the privileges and immunities and my little rant on the voting and so forth. And I know that there's probably a few people that are throwing bricks at their radio. I hope you broke it. Anyway. All right, so the next one, a person charged. This one right here. So you hear me say that we can deport every congressman out of D.C. when they violate their oath of office. Here you go. Read this next paragraph.
A person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime who shall flee from justice and be found in another state shall, on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled, be delivered up to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime.
Okay. So when a public servant that's serving in the House of Representatives actually violates their oath, or a senator in the Senate, of course. I mean, you wouldn't be a senator in the House of Representatives, but a senator who is doing something in the Senate that is either an insurrection against the Constitution, like what Schumer's doing, or, you know, a Senate, better yet, a senator who's being called by their state legislature saying, we want you to vote this very specific way. Because when we get to Article 5, we're going to find out that the state legislature still has control over how they vote. It is their suffrage. They're representing their suffrage. And if they don't represent their suffrage, then they should have the ability to remove them. And they do. State legislatures have the ability to remove their senators. But when we kind of look at this right here, and we say, okay, they're not following the law, then a person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime. So when you're actually violating the Constitution, Section 3 of the Constitution, you're running an insurrection. We're not calling it treason. We're just basically saying you are committing a crime against the Constitution, and therefore the state has, right here, the authority to have them, what do you want to call it, deported or actually extradited from the District of Columbia back to the state. I honestly think that it is in the state's best interest today to actually start creating a bench of replacements for their Senate and starting to, you know, and I think it would be important at the county level to actually start creating a bench for the House of Representatives as well. Because we need to be quick in pulling them, because when you actually react, not in a mean way, but immediate. In other words, when you actually pull somebody from their seat in Congress because they've done something, boom, they're gone. Well, what happened? That state saw what that person did, and they said that's a crime against the Constitution. And they just deported them or extradited them. And this other guy's walking in, and who are you? Oh, I was that guy. You got to be kidding me. You guys don't. Well, we already have a process in place to replace these people. And then all of a sudden, the lights will start coming on. Wow, they're already planning on removing us.
Mm-hmm.
That is what smart institutions do. As a matter of fact, it's almost like when you look at pro sports, don't they have a bench? They already got a guy that's going to go in to basically execute a specific play or to pull somebody to, you know, give them a break or whatever.
That makes sense.
Why aren't we doing that? We need to not only get good people in, we need to have a bench to be able to replace anybody and everybody. So anyway, and as a matter of fact, I know the governor has the ability to replace people, and I know, so anywhere in the Constitution, here's the interesting thing. In the Constitution, does a person have to live within their congressional district to serve that congressional district?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so where is that in Article 1?
I don't know. Is it not in there?
So when we look at, I'm going to look up the word seven, C-E-V-E-N, because that's where they actually cover, help me out here. That's where they cover the prerequisites of a House of Representatives. No person shall be a representative. This is the requirements. No person shall be a representative who should not have attained to the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of the state in which he's to be chosen. You only have to be a state resident. The Constitution didn't create this requirement of the people to actually be from that. It's deduced that that's what we do, but that's not in the Constitution. Does that make sense? Now, with the Senate, obviously that is a representation of the Senate, the state anyway, the state legislature. But the House of Representatives, I honestly think that the state can create a bench for an immediate removal so that we have somebody that we put in place real quick that is, you know, abreast with the fact that here we got a champion. We're going to put that champion in, and boom, we'll wait till the next election for somebody in the vicinage to, you know, come up and be nurtured to be able to go into that seat. Does that make sense? Because we're only talking. Go ahead.
How do they choose who's on the bench?
Well, so I honestly think that this is where the electors could come in. If we had state electors that were focused on constitutional compliance, then potentially your state elector could be one of those people.
I see.
Does that make sense? I mean, you now have somebody that has, you know, a wealth of knowledge, that has this respect and so forth. They're not serving, but they serve in the capacity as an elector in choosing the governor and in choosing, you know, other statewide offices that may not be under the executive, if that makes sense, like judges. But I honestly believe that, you know, if we should follow the U.S. Constitution and the governor should appoint, and those people are replaced, if necessary, by the new governor. The governor has, each governor has the ability to completely clean house. And I think, yeah. I think that they should be able to do that, especially when we look at the deep state in D.C. So anyway, so we're back to section two. And there's this other part here that has been amended out because of the 13th Amendment. So if you actually are reading the Constitution, and it is not one that has reflects these amendments, then one person would actually read this, no person held to service or labor in one state, that you'd read this and think, well, this is legitimate. That personal servitude and actually slavery is still legitimate in our Constitution. Do you see I really believe Madison nailed it in the debates on the Bill of Rights in Congress when he said, we need to remove these things. We need to inject what needs to be there and remove what doesn't belong there anymore. Anyway, Section 3. Now, Section 3, and we got 6 minutes, so we'll probably really dive into this. There's two paragraphs to Section 3. The role and responsibility is identified in the first paragraph with some, you know, some hesitations or some reservations, you know, and then the ancillary stuff is in the second paragraph. In other words, we're giving, well, go ahead and read this. Read the first colored line into the semicolon.
Okay. Right? Go ahead. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state.
Okay, so that's two. That's two lines. Oh, okay. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this union. Semicolon. That right there is a role and responsibility delegated to Congress. So when states seceded in the Civil War, they left, they actually packed up, they abandoned their posts, they sent in secession letters, or they just stopped showing up. Doesn't matter. They just went away. Okay, you're out of the state. You're out of the union. All right, you're out. How do those states come back in? Did they come right back in? Oh, well, we're, you know, it was a nice little vacation or a sabbatical from the union. No, they can't just come back in. It states right here, who has the responsibility of admitting states into the union? Congress.
Yeah, Congress.
Okay. And then, but no new state shall be formed. So now these are these caveats, right? They have this responsibility. There's some caveats here. So no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of another state. Go ahead and read the rest of the caveats of the first paragraph. Go ahead.
But no new state shall be formed, or I already read that, nor any state be formed by the jurisdiction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the state concerned as well as of the Congress.
Okay, so if Wyoming was going to be divided, then the Wyoming state legislature would have to buy into and approve of the division of East Wyoming to West Wyoming, or North and South, right? So if Wyoming, if the northeast corner is going to secede, or they want to adjoin with, what is that? Is that the Dakotas? I think that's the Dakotas. So let's say they want to adjoin with South Dakota. And that would require the state legislature of Wyoming and the state legislature of South Dakota to approve the division or the separation of that parcel, that part of property, and to these properties to adjoin and create a new state. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in other words, they can't just, you know, say we're done. You have to get the state legislature's permission. Now, the next set of clauses, and you notice it's all highlighted in red, which means that this is where they violate all of this. This right here are the ancillary things necessary for their admission of states or this responsibility that Congress has. So go ahead. When you see the word power, that does not mean this is a full enumerated permanent power. Go ahead and read that first clause to the semicolon, which is in the second line. Go ahead.
The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States.
So when that property becomes a state, all those needful rules and regulations go away. The state actually steps in, or I should say the state is formed, the counties that are operating within that territory then form and create that state constitution, and then they create the state and determine where that state, you know, capital is going to be, and so forth and so on. So they have this ability, as they stand up this new state, of self-destiny. Anything that the federal government has done is gone. In other words, they only have this ancillary authority while it is a territory in transition to become a state. Because does the federal government have the ability to permanently possess, create, and possess territory?
No.
If it was, then it would be enumerated up in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection, 16? Where they have all the property listed, right? With magazines, forts, arsenals, shipyards, and needful buildings, and territories. They would have included the territory there. The only reason that they put territory here was because they knew that they had territory to the west of them. And they knew that the federal government would basically take cognizance over that territory, even though many of the states had their own territories. Virginia had Kentucky. North Carolina had Tennessee. And I think it was Vermont. Was it Vermont? No, New Hampshire had Vermont and Maine. And Pennsylvania had the Ohio and the Northwest area that they called in the Northwest Ordinance. So when they actually started dividing this and preparing these things to sever and come into the Union as a state, then Congress, they go under the charge of Congress so that Congress can prepare them into coming into the Union. So with that, we just ran out of time. And we still got to finish this, but this will allow you time, Tammy, when you come back on Tuesday, Wednesday, it'll give you time to come up with any questions you may have regarding this. But anyway, folks, this is how important it is for counties to stand up their states. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.